coach that we are friends, after a bit of tossing the dice, we decided that this is not an academic quarter session, so we start at 11 sharp. And I'm really, really happy to welcome our soon-to-be honorary doctor, Scott Jarvis, Professor Scott Jarvis from the University of Utah. We all know Scott from years ago. He's been to UVascular before in the academic year 2009-2010, I think it was, at the Center for Applied Language Studies. He's been involved in several projects with the university. There are several people you've worked with still here today. And he's obviously an expert on second language acquisition. Myöskin puhuu erinomaisesti suomea. Mä en ole ihan varma, että pidetäänkö tämän varmaankin englanniksi tämä esitellä, mutta hyvä. Me voidaan yhtä hyvin pitää suomeksi. Scott and Tampere and I are non-native speakers in the US legal system, misunderstanding the police warning. Please join me in welcoming Scott Jarvis.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's exciting to be here to talk to you today. As she said, my area of specialty is second language acquisition, and within that, I tend to focus on cross-linguistic influence, or how your knowledge of one language affects how you acquire and use another language. And I also research lexical diversity, or especially how to measure the variety of words that we use in our speech and in our writing, and how that reflects our level of language ability. It's been a real privilege to work with several of you in those two areas, and publish papers with you and present at conferences. Recently, I have found myself drawn into another area of linguistics as well, though I have not abandoned those other two. But this other area of linguistics is sometimes referred to as forensic linguistics, and it has to do with the relationship between language and the law. And I'll tell you how I got into that. The story starts in Arizona. This is actually where I was born, but I'm not going to tell you my own personal story. By the way, right now we live in Utah, and 2 years ago we lived in Ohio, so we've been all over the place. In Arizona, Phoenix is the capital of Arizona, and in 1941, there was a little baby born named him Ernesto Miranda. His father was an immigrant from Mexico. This is what he looks like. What he looked like when he grew up. This picture was taken in the 1960s. His native language evidently was English. I don't know much about his mother except that she passed away when he was only six. And from that point forward, he had a lot of difficulties getting along with his family members. Didn't get along well with his father. His father married again within just a year after Ernesto's mother passed away. He did not get along with his stepmother or his siblings. Started getting into bad trouble. By the time he was 14, he was already being arrested for things like burglary, stealing cars, peeping into the windows of neighbors and so forth. By the time he was 16, he was also arrested for attempted sexual assault. He served time in prison. By the time he was about 20, though, things were getting a little bit better. He met a girlfriend. He went to California briefly. He met a girlfriend, and he convinced her to move back to Phoenix with him, and they did. And things were going well. He had a good job there, and she did as well. But then one night, this was 1963, there was a movie playing in movie theaters back then called The Longest Day, which I've never seen. I don't know if you've seen it or not. Apparently, it's a really long movie. But there was an 18-year-old girl working at a movie theater in Phoenix, and she had to be there until the last movie was finished, and then she could leave. And this movie didn't end until about 11:30 p.m. And then she left. She got on the bus and went back to her neighborhood and got off the bus. And when she got off the bus and was walking to her house, this car right here pulled up in front of her. This car happened to belong to Ernesto's girlfriend, and he was driving it. He got out of the car and ran up to the girl. He had a knife with him, and he told her to be quiet and she wouldn't be hurt. And then he tied her up, put her in the car, drove out into the desert, sexually assaulted her, and then took her back to her neighborhood, let her out of the car. She went back home and, of course, told her family what had happened. They immediately called the police. But everything was dark and it happened quickly, and she couldn't remember exactly, you know, what this person looked like. She was too afraid to walk to the bus stop anymore, so her brother started driving her to the bus stop and picking her up from the bus stop when she came home. And about 9 days after this happened, when her brother was driving her to the bus stop, she saw this car again being driven by Ernesto Miranda. And she told her brother, and they started following the car until they could get the license plate number. And that day they called the police, and the police showed up at the house of Ernesto's girlfriend the day after, because the car was registered to her. Ernesto had gotten home that morning at 8 o'clock in the morning. He worked a night shift. And the police showed up at 9 a.m., woke him up, took him to the police station, and put him in a lineup. He's number one right here. And the victim, had, you probably know how this works. There's a window right here, and these people can't see who's behind the window, but she can see them. The police asked her, they said, "Do you recognize any of these men?" And she said, "I can't be sure, but I think it might be number one." Then when Ernesto came out of that room, he said to the police, he said, "How did I do?" And the police lied to him and said, "You did very, very poorly. You were identified as the perpetrator of the crime." So then they took him into an interrogation room where he went ahead and confessed and said, "Yeah, I did it." And it was a 2-hour interrogation, and about an hour into it, they brought the girl in. And before she had a chance to say anything, he himself said, "Yeah, that's the girl." So he identified her. By the end of the interrogation, he wrote out his confession and signed it. So then what happened is they put him in jail, of course, and he waited for his trial, which took place about 3 months later. This was in June of 1963. And the prosecutor entered as evidence nothing more than his own confession, but that was enough. The jury unanimously said he's guilty, and the judge sentenced him to 20 to 30 years in prison. But his own lawyer was not happy about this. His own lawyer went back to look at what happened during the police interrogation and also looked at the U.S. Constitution, which says you have a right not to testify against yourself. And the lawyer said he didn't know his right. He didn't know that right. He also didn't know that he could talk to a lawyer before you interviewed him. Well, anyways, the lawyer appealed the case to higher courts. It eventually went to the Arizona Supreme Court, but they upheld the original conviction. So his lawyer tried one more time, and this time the appeal went to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court back then was, the Chief Justice at the time was Chief Justice Warren. And they were a fairly liberal court, and they were very committed to, at least five of them were very committed to advancing human rights and due process and things like this. They looked carefully at this case. They actually chose three cases. There had been dozens of cases around the country that were very similar to Miranda's. And they chose three of them. They listed his case first because Miranda occurred in the alphabet before those other two cases, but all three were looked at the same time. And the majority of the justices, there are nine justices, so five of them said, we need to take seriously what the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution says, which is that you should not be compelled to be a witness against yourself. And Amendment 6, which says you have the right to counsel or to a lawyer. And you should have the right to access the lawyer before you're interrogated. So there, by a vote of 5-4, the majority opinion was that they decided to overturn the case. So Miranda was no longer convicted. He was released from prison immediately. They said in their decision, a defendant must be warned prior to any questioning that he has the right to remain silent, that anything he says can be used against him in a court of law, that he has the right to the presence of an attorney, and that if he cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for him prior to any questioning if he so desires. You've probably heard that wording before, right? What I think is quite interesting, so immediately after this decision by the Supreme Court, police departments throughout the country came up with their own Miranda warnings. And what they decided to do was to take almost the exact language from the Supreme Court decision. This is pretty important because the Supreme Court was not, their audience was not regular people like you and me. It was other judges and lawyers. This was legal language. And so it's legal language that the police use when they arrest people. And as you can see right here, the wording is almost identical. So one, you have the right to remain silent. That's what the Warren Court said. Anything you say can be used against you, right there, and so on and so forth. Importantly, there's a waiver here too. A person can give up these rights, can say, it's fine, I'll go ahead and confess. You can do that. The Supreme Court, as part of the same decision, said that the defendant may waive the effectuation of these rights provided the waiver is made voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. So how do police determine whether a person has knowingly given up his rights? Well, they ask him. They say, do you understand these rights as they've been explained to you? That seems like a pretty good test. You know, I tell you something, do you understand? Yes. And they take that as evidence that the person understood and is giving them up. And they, of course, they ask them to sign a waiver. The problem is, though, there was this study in 1981 by Grisso that investigated whether people who are arrested actually do understand their rights, and found that only 21% of juveniles and only 42% of adult offenders actually understand their rights fully. These are native speakers. If native speakers have such a hard time understanding their rights, then just think about how much more difficult it is for non-native speakers to understand the Miranda rights. So that's the question. I'm going to give you one example. There have been many, many court cases involving non-native speakers as the suspects who were arrested that have then later gone to trial. And a linguist has been brought in to look at whether that person is likely to have actually understood the Miranda rights or not. In some cases, the judge allows the testimony to come in, or actually sometimes the judge simply takes the linguist's word and says, okay, this person probably didn't understand the rights, so we're going to throw out that part of the interview up to the point, or actually maybe throw out the entire police interview if they didn't understand the rights. I'm going to give you one example. This person right here, Irina Zlatnikov, she was a Russian student at Temple University in Philadelphia. As you can see here, this is her headstone. She was murdered in her home with a blunt instrument on December 23, 2004, in a suburb of Philadelphia. She was living together with her boyfriend, this person right here, who was also a Russian speaker. His name was Robert, and he was also studying in a university in the Philadelphia area. He's the one who came home. He came home and found her that day. She was unconscious. She had been beaten really badly, apparently with a stick or something really heavy and hard. Mm-hmm. He called an ambulance immediately. They took her to the hospital, and she was pronounced dead when she got there. So this was December 23rd. He was interviewed by the police that same day to find out if he may have been guilty. The police weren't quite sure, but they found out from him that he had had a previous girlfriend who was also a Russian speaker. It was this person right here, whose real name was Irina also, but to keep from confusing the Irinas, we'll call her Natasha. She was from Russia. She was a student at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. She was a student of business, but her English skills were somewhat questionable. In fact, some of the courses that she took in the business school, she had to take three times in order to pass them. The police initially questioned her 2 days after the murder. This was on Christmas Day in 2004. And then after they gathered more and more evidence, they called her again 5 days later. And the detective who called her was very polite, said, Natasha, this is Detective so-and-so. We have some more questions for you and wondered if you could maybe come down to the police station and talk to us just for a little while. We have some questions about your boyfriend, Robert. She's like, well, okay. So they didn't lead her to believe that she was a suspect at all. When she got there, they were very kind to her. They brought her into an interview room and offered her coffee, water, anything she wanted, made sure that she was comfortable. And then very soon after that, they said, we need to ask you these questions. It's, you know, this is just a formality. We ask these questions of everyone. They made it sound like it wasn't anything serious. And those questions were the Miranda rights that they read to her with a question at the end, which is, you know, do you understand these rights and knowing these things, are you willing to talk to us? They videotaped the entire interview with her, and when you look back at it, at this videotape, which I haven't done, but some other people have, they found that she really doesn't show any indication that she understood that she was under arrest until an hour and a half into the interview. And at that point, she said something like, you mean you think I'm the one who killed her? And she also said, I think I'm in trouble. And she also said, I think I need a lawyer. The police ignored all of these things. And she also said, could I call my father and see if he could get a lawyer for me? They ignored that as well. After 3 hours, she was more assertive and said, can we please stop the interview? They didn't stop. It wasn't until 5 hours that they finally stopped and they took her to jail. They were convinced at that point that she was indeed guilty. Actually, they were convinced before they even brought her in that she was the guilty one. This is important, and I think it's important for anyone who's in the United States to know that if police officers are reading you your Miranda rights, they have a theory of the crime that puts you as one of the suspects. So that's what happened. Many of you know Annetta Pavlenko. She's been here, I know. But she lived in Philadelphia. Actually, she still lives in Philadelphia. But back then, she worked for Temple University. And she was sitting in her office grading papers and got a phone call. This was about 5 months after the murder took place. She got a phone call from the lawyer, Natasha's lawyer. And she didn't know anything about this case. The lawyer said, hello, this is so-and-so. I'm an attorney, and I represent Natasha so-and-so in this case involving a murder, and I'd like to ask you if you would help consult on this particular case. And Annetta's first reaction was, I think you must have the wrong number. I'm a linguist, and she hung up the phone. So about 2 minutes later, the lawyer called again and said, no, really, it is you that I want to talk to. And then he explained what had happened. He himself had looked at the videotape of the interview and said, I'm quite certain that my client did not understand her Miranda rights, and I need someone with more expertise in language and linguistics to come and look at this video to see if this is correct. So she was given access not only to the video recording, but also to transcripts of Natasha's phone conversations with the police, as well as some school records from the University of Pennsylvania where Natasha was going to school, where Annetta found out how much trouble she was having in her courses and how she had to hire tutors to help her. So Annetta did a very thorough analysis. She looked at the person's pronunciation, grammar, word use. She also looked at some of the things that took place in the interrogation with the police. So the kinds of strategies that the police were using to make Natasha think that it was that she was not a suspect at first, and then how Natasha responded to that to show that she apparently didn't understand what was happening. Annetta also looked at the questions that Natasha asked as well as the comments that she made to show what she did understand and what she didn't understand, and also some verbal and nonverbal cues. After looking at everything carefully, Annetta came to the careful conclusion that Natasha, even though she was fairly conversant in simple topics in English, she really didn't have a strong command of English, and she had some serious problems understanding the language. So Annetta concluded that even though Natasha signed the Miranda warning waiver form, she did not do so with a full awareness of the nature of the right being abandoned and the consequences of the decision to abandon it. And and thus did not waive her rights voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. So she gave this report to the lawyer who hired her, and that lawyer took it to the judge, and the judge had a special hearing and looked carefully at the analysis and then decided to dismiss it. So it kind of looked like the judge was biased against linguists, or at least against Annetta, maybe thinking that since Annetta herself is a native Russian speaker, maybe she was trying to help a fellow Russian speaker. Something similar happened a couple years after this. Annetta was hired to be an expert witness in another murder case, and the judge did the same thing, dismissed her testimony. I don't think that the problem is just bias, although judges may indeed be biased against linguists at this point. I think perhaps they don't see it as a well-established field in the same way that they see some other fields as established. But there's something else going on here too, and it's called the Daubert standard. In a court case in 1993, the Supreme Court ruled, they made recommendations for judges concerning the sorts of criteria they need to take into consideration when deciding whether an expert witness's testimony should be accepted as evidence for the trial. And here's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. They said, take into consideration whether the technique or the method used by the expert witness has been subject to peer review, whether you can actually find that method in published articles in that person's field, whether the method used by that person is valid and reliable, and here they refer to the potential rate of error. Also, do standards exist for the control of the technique's operation? Basically, is this a legitimate method that has been peer-reviewed within the field and has been accepted, generally accepted within the relevant scientific community? Probably Annetta's problem, and this has happened not just to her but to other forensic linguists as well, is that their testimony is not seen as meeting the Daubert standard, and so it's thrown out by judges. So when Annetta realized this, she said, we have to do research in this area so that when she or any other forensic linguist in the future goes to trial, you can point back to studies that have been done in this area and compare your analysis with, for example, probabilities that have been found in previous research. So that's what she decided to do. She actually contacted me. She and I had published some work together previous to that, and in 2006 she said, Scott, will you help me? We need to come up with a study that actually looks at Miranda rights and people's ability to understand Miranda rights, both native speakers and non-native speakers. So we got together just before the 2016 AAAL conference in Orlando, and we thought this through. We came up with a study that had many different tasks. I'm only going to talk about two of those tasks today. We finished collecting the data about a year ago. The research questions that we were addressing were these. Do educated non-native speakers of English understand the Miranda rights? Number two, if they do, what level of proficiency does this require? Number three, how do non-native speakers compare to educated native speakers in terms of their ability to understand the Miranda rights? Number four, is their level of confidence? If they say, yes, I understand, is that a good indicator that they really do? And number five, if they don't understand, what are some of the ways that they might misunderstand Miranda rights? This is important because people say, yes, I understand, for many different reasons. I mean, one reason could be that you don't want to embarrass yourself. You want people to think that your language abilities are better than they really are. So you might say, yes, I understand, just so you don't embarrass yourself. Another reason, which is probably more frequent in police interviews, is you understand there's an important power differential. The police have a lot of power over you, and they can put you in jail and do a lot of things that are not pleasant. And so people tend to be very deferential. They want to seem cooperative to the police officers. And so if they say, do you understand? You might say yes, because you want to seem cooperative. But the third reason that someone might say yes, even if they don't understand, is because they think they do understand. And so we wanted to look at this as well. We actually collected data from almost 300 participants, but a subset, I'm going to talk about just a subsection of those. We assigned the participants to different conditions, and the condition that is the most relevant to what we're looking at was what I call a paraphrasing condition. And we'll talk about just those participants who participated in that part of the study. So there were 41 native English speakers. Most of them were tested at the University of Utah, where I work. And there were also 21 L1 Arabic speakers who were non-native speakers of English, and 51 Chinese speakers, non-native speakers of English. Mm-hmm. And the non-native speakers, most of them were tested in Philadelphia at universities there. All of these participants were university students. The non-native speakers were all taking English classes. Not all of them were in intensive English programs. If they were in intensive English programs, they were at the upper levels. This is a breakdown of the proficiency levels using the Common European Framework scale. Now, the students themselves, their proficiency was tested, but not in the European framework. So these represent converted scores. That's why we have things like B1 to C1 and B2 plus. But these are the approximate proficiency levels. You might know on the CEFR scale, the very lowest proficiency is A1, and there's also A2. None of these participants were that low. They're actually more advanced than that. And if you're familiar with the descriptions of each of these proficiency levels, you know that by the B2 level, you would probably expect them to be able to understand legal language. Certainly by C1 and C2 levels, right? All right, so this shows the number of participants, both Arabic speakers and Chinese speakers, in each of those categories of proficiency. We gave them a listening test, which was actually a dictation test. We had 20 sentences that were recorded by a former police officer so that they would hear. And we asked him, please say these sentences, record these sentences in the same tone of voice that you would read the Miranda rights in. And he did that for us. We played each sentence, one sentence at a time, to the participants and asked them to write down exactly what they heard after each sentence. Importantly, there were four different kinds of sentences. There were those that were short and simple with common words, common everyday words. There were also sentences that were long and complex but had common everyday words. Then we also had short and simple sentences that involved legal terms, and also long and complex sentences with legal terms. There were five sentences within each set, and they were just mixed up in a mixed order. Here are some examples of the different kinds of sentences. So short and simple, longer and complex, but with simple words. And then we have a simple sentence structure with legal words. And then set four, which is actually the most similar to the Miranda rights statements. So long and complex sentences with legal terminology. I'll show you the results of that test soon. Then we also had the paraphrasing task that I told you about earlier. We had that police officer record the Miranda rights sentences. There are seven sentences in Miranda rights, and he recorded them. We played them for the participants one at a time and asked them to write down what they understood in their own words. They didn't have to write it down word for word. Here are the results, first of the Miranda rights paraphrasing task. We found these are the native English speakers, so this is called a box plot. The central tendencies of each group are found in the blue box itself, and the line right here is the median or the middle of each group. They extend down to what's called a fence, upper fence and a lower fence. There were 20 possible points depending on, so the participants' paraphrases of the Miranda rights were scored according to how many of the rights they actually referred to. And there were the maximum score would have been 22. There were some native English speakers, there were four, who actually got every single right correct. But some other native English speakers actually didn't do so well. There were three here who did worse than the rest of the group, who actually didn't fit within the normal distribution of that group. We determined that the lowest score that native English speakers make and can still be considered to be native-like is a score of 15. And you see that that none of the non-native speakers exceeded the score of 15. We used 15 as a cutoff for kind of the threshold level of comprehending the Miranda rights. And you see here, these are the results of the Arabic speakers and Chinese speakers at their different levels of proficiency. Let's look at how many of them actually comprehended their Miranda rights at that threshold level. Well, no one at levels B1 through B2 plus comprehended the Miranda rights at even that threshold level. There was one person out of six among the non-native speakers who understood their Miranda rights at that level, and actually that person, that one person got a 15, which is just barely at that threshold level. So that represents 16.67% of our participants at the C1 level. At the C2 level, we had only one participant, one of the two. Now, we need more data to see whether this is actually generalizable, but only one of the two people at the C2 level comprehended their Miranda rights. Pretty disturbing, isn't it? So overall, we found that only two out of the 71 non-native speakers understood the Miranda rights at the very lowest level that could be considered to be understanding, so less than 3%. Next, we looked at confidence. Not all of the participants were asked to rate how confident they were that they understood each sentence from the Miranda rights, but 24 of the Chinese speakers did do this. So immediately after they heard a sentence and they paraphrased it, they were also asked, how confident are you that you understood it correctly? Here are a couple of things that are interesting and also a bit disturbing. There were 14 cases where a participant indicated at least an 80% level of confidence, like, I'm sure I understood it, and yet they had zero understanding. 14 cases like that. In 36.7% of the cases where Chinese participants demonstrated no better than 50%, so it was 50% or worse comprehension, their confidence was 60% or higher. So in short, when people say, yes, I understand the Miranda rights, there's a good chance that they actually don't. So going back now to that first task, the listening task, listening comprehension, remember there were four types of sentences. Set 1, set 2, set 3, and set 4, where these set 4 is the most like the what you would hear in the Miranda rights. These results here are only for the native speakers so far. So you see, these are percentages basically that goes up to 100%, 1.0. You see that the native speakers for set 1, set 2, and set 3 get 90% or better correct in their comprehension of those sentences. But they get only about 50% right for the long, complex, legal sentences. Only 50% right. And for the native English speakers, it's probably not a matter of not understanding the terminology. It's probably more a matter of memory. These are complex sentences and they're very long, so there's a lot to remember. So if they're difficult for native speakers to remember, they're probably really difficult for non-native speakers. Here's what we see with the Arabic speakers. Let's concentrate on this for right now. The Arabic speakers actually do pretty well with the short and simple sentences with common words. In fact, they're not so different from the native speakers. And this is actually a huge problem. We have learned from some judges that when they determine whether a non-native speaker needs an interpreter or not, the judge himself or herself will interview that person and will use short and simple sentences with common words and say, yeah, this person understands fine. You don't need an interpreter. But if you look at these other kinds of sentences, long and complex, even with common words, their comprehension is less than 40%. And it gets really bad when you have Miranda rights-like sentences. Here are the Chinese speakers. Similar patterns, but even lower comprehension. Here's some examples of how the participants misconstrued what they heard. So in this sentence, this is a set three sentence, so short and simple sentences with legal terminology. Jurors decide who is guilty. Here are some examples of how the Arabic speakers and Chinese speakers understood that sentence. Who decided who's guilty? Joe decided, or George decided, or Jews will decide who is guilty. That's what they understood, and they were confident they understood it correctly. Yeah, right. Here's a sentence from set four. The American legal system depends on the precedents set by previous cases. Can you guess what they might have said there? The American legal system depends on what or who? The president. Obviously. There were two Arabic speakers who said that, and more than half of the Chinese speakers. It's a bit disturbing. Now let's look back at the Miranda rights sentences, because these were also misunderstood. One of the rights, you have the right to remain silent. And here are some of the things that we found. So first of all, there was a 25.3% comprehension across both the Arabic speakers and Chinese speakers. We had some people who said, you have to stay quiet. Not you have the right to remain silent, but you have to. Another person said, you have to write something. They understood write as right and silent as something. In fact, a person I've been working with, he and I taught a course in forensic linguistics last fall. He's been involved in a number of cases, and most recently a case in Texas where an Urdu speaker was arrested, and he showed me the videotape of the interrogation with the police. The police brought him handcuffed into the interrogation room. They had him sit down. He was really uncomfortable because his hands were behind him and he was sitting in a really uncomfortable seat. And the police start by saying, so are you a Spanish speaker? No, Urdu. And they're like, Urdu? Do you speak Spanish? No. They wouldn't believe him because he looked like a Spanish speaker. Then finally they said, we're going to read you these rights. We'll read them slowly and then we'll ask if you understand. So this is actually better than reading all of them and say, do you understand? They read one at a time. They said, you have the right to remain silent. Do you understand? He's like, no. But it's interesting that when they said, you have the right, apparently this man heard, you have to write, and he immediately looked for a pen on the table. For this right, you have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present while you're being questioned. We broke this down into two separate rights. One, you have the right to a lawyer, and the second, to have that lawyer present with you while you're being questioned. So let's look at the first one. This had an accuracy of just over 50%. You have the right to talk to a lawyer. Interesting, you have the right to talk to a presenter. Well, where did that come from? Present. Have a right to talk to president. It's interesting how many people thought president was president. Primarily the Chinese speakers, the Arabic speakers were more likely to think that present was prison. And some of them, when they heard this, they thought, oh, you have the right to have a lawyer in prison. But not before then, right? For the second part, to have him present with you while you're being questioned, it's okay to bring a lawyer to court. Again, not until you actually go to trial. You can talk to your lawyer, about why you're being questioned. And if you have a question, they didn't understand the question means an interrogation, they thought it just meant you can ask questions. For this one, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to represent you before any questioning if you wish. We also broke this down into two parts. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed, so be given one for free. And the second part, one will be given to you for free before the interrogation. Okay? So with the first part, 7% got it right. You can sign anytime. I'm not really sure what that comes from, but maybe they thought appointed has something to do with the appointment and you have to sign something to get that appointment. I don't know. They know that the second person knew that afford has something to do with money, so can you afford it? You have to pay it tonight. Another person thought, okay, this has something to do with questions. We'll answer your questions if you want. If you cannot afford it, you can have a conversation to talk about it. They don't seem to understand that they have the right to an attorney for free, even if they need to. And the second part, that they have the right to the attorney before any questioning, this person said, you can get an appointment before you present if you went. Clearly didn't understand. You will in the prison if you can afford that. And then with this one, you can decide at any time to exercise these rights and not answer any questions or make any statements. This is often referred to as the continuity of rights, meaning that even if you say right now that you give up your rights, 2 minutes later you can say, you know what, I'm going to invoke those rights after all. Those rights don't go away, even if you sign the waiver. Do they understand this? Only 18.3% comprehension. Here's what some of them said. Instead of having the right to remain silent, one of them thought you have to answer. Another one, you can write anytime, you can practice anytime, probably getting that from exercise. You can decide at any time to do exercise, right? You can exercise without doing other things, and you can choose the time for exercises. Like maybe when you go to prison, you can exercise in the prison yard. Anyway, so this was pretty eye-opening to see the sorts of responses that we're getting, how people actually understood their Miranda rights. Just as a summary, for each right, this is how each group did. So the native English speakers did quite well with each of the rights except for the free access before questioning. Somehow even the native English speakers missed that point. The non-native speakers did fairly well on the right to have a lawyer at some point. They just didn't seem to know when they could have access to the lawyer. And with this one, free access before questioning, not a single one of the non-native speakers understood that. So here's a summary. First of all, educated non-native speakers tend not to be able to understand the Miranda warning adequately, even at the C1 and C2 proficiency levels. There's absolutely no guarantee that a non-native speaker will understand the Miranda rights. Two, there is, as I just said, there's no proficiency level where comprehension is guaranteed or even likely. Possibly at the C2 level, we had 50%, but there were only 2 participants there. That's a bit troubling. Next, when they hear the Miranda rights, non-native speakers tend to do their best to try to create a meaning that seems to fit what they're hearing. Even if they really didn't understand what they heard, they try to create a meaning that works, and often that meaning is very, very different from what their actual rights are. As I mentioned also, their confidence in their interpretation is a poor indicator of how well they actually understood. And what they understood is often dangerously different from what their rights actually are. I think especially of the person who said that you have to talk instead of you have the right to remain silent. I don't know how they understand that completely opposite of what it was. And finally, here's some positive steps forward. I think this is kind of the good news, or at least the positive outlook, which is that we do need to conduct research in this area. Fortunately, just relatively recently, I think it was a month ago, this research that Annetta and I did, we also did this with a person named Beth Hepford, who lived in Philadelphia and was one of Annetta's students. We decided to work with a law professor at Seattle University who has published in law journals before, and she heard us give a talk on this before. She said, if you're willing, I will help you write this up for a law journal. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever read an article on a law journal, but the way they write is totally different from how linguists write. You have a little bit of text on each page and a whole bunch of footnotes, and it's pretty crazy. But so this woman's name is Janet Ainsworth, and she's actually the current vice president of the International Association for Forensic Linguistics. But so we wrote up our study, and then we sent it to Janet, and she turned it into a legal article, and then submitted it to a journal, and it was recently accepted for publication by the Ohio State Law Review. So we're looking forward to getting this published. And Janet told us this is very important. It's one thing to publish papers in linguistics journals where your colleagues can read them and be really impressed and like, wow, that's great. But she said, if you really want to change how things are working in the US legal system, it's important for judges to read what you're doing. And for that reason, you need to publish in law journals. So we did that. That's a start, but there's a need for more research in this area. Similarly, we need to inform the legal community of our findings. I've been trying to do this also. For the 2 past years, I've held a forum on language and the law at the University of Utah and invited as many lawyers and judges from the Utah area as I could, and that's going pretty well. We also need to encourage police to change their practices. It turns out that police don't actually have to read the Miranda rights word for word. they can summarize, paraphrase them, they can simplify the language. And they probably should do so. Use simplified versions of the Miranda rights. For non-native speakers, it would be great to have simplified versions in the learner's own native languages. Maybe have it on an iPad or something, and just show it to them, or maybe even have it recorded and say, listen to this, and tell me if you understand your rights. Use interpreters, of course. And then ask the detained persons, not did you understand, yes or no, but what did you understand? Please say it back in your own words, what you understand your rights are, to make sure that they really do understand their rights. And last here, if and when linguists in the future are called to testify in similar cases, as Annetta has and as Bill Eggington and many other linguists have done, we need to be prepared not to do a really nice, thorough qualitative analysis, as Annetta has done, but to be able to tie our analysis to previous research and to show the judge that what we have done is scientifically valid, that our results are also reliable, that our method is replicable, and that the method that we have used really has been accepted by the scientific community that we're a part of. These might seem like tall orders, but I do believe that if we do these things, we are very well positioned to actually make the world a better place, at least as far as the legal system is concerned. And I will stop on that note. Thank you.